Of Tucson Planning Commission. My name is Anna Cassidy and I'm the chair of the Planning Commission. The responsibilities of this body are to advise the mayor and council and the Planning and Development Services Department on the adoption of long-range plans, policies, specific plans, and regulations that affect land use and development. Will staff call the roll, please?
Course. Yes, Chair Cassidy.
Here.
Vice Chair Wellett.
Present.
Commissioner Martin.
Here.
Commissioner Zagier. Absent. Commissioner Paffer.
Here.
Commissioner Young.
Here.
Absent. Oh, yeah, there you go. Commissioner Ortiz Pino.
Here.
Commissioner Schwartz.
Here.
Commissioner Warake.
Here.
Commissioner Lane. Absent. Commissioner McKenzie.
Present.
And Commissioner Kinney.
Present.
We have a quorum.
Okay, thank you. Item number two, approval of the legal action report for January 25th, 2023. I would entertain a motion for the approval of the legal action report for January 25th.
I'll go ahead and make a motion to approve the legal action report.
Okay, we have a motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Any discussion? All those in favor of recommending this item to mayor and council say aye.
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 All opposed say nay. Okay, motion passes. Item number three. Would staff please provide the presentation for item number three, Planning and Development Services Department Update Package UDC Text Amendment?
Okay. All right, sharing my screen. Excellent. All right, so this is item number four. It's a PDSD code update package. This is a public hearing. And Keisha Dupierre from our department will start off with this presentation. So thank you, Acacia.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Good evening, commissioners. Good evening, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. As you may know, this initiative was started at a mayor and council meeting back in June, directing staff to take a new approach in improving portions of the city's development code. And that actually includes a range of documents. And I'll give more detail on that in a little bit. But this process has included research, outreach, public meetings, and now this public hearing to review a package of proposed updates in these themed areas. That includes improving PDSD processes, removing barriers to small-scale infill, simplifying development standards, and correcting minor code errors. So, as I mentioned, development of this package has included outreach, and that has been to stakeholder groups, neighborhoods, and development representatives. We also got feedback from the staff perspective, both in our own department and elsewhere in the city. And we were really impressed to see a lot of engagement on this topic through an online survey where there were over 130 responses. We have reviewed all of those comments. They've been documented throughout various meetings and hearing materials. And so there are lots of great ideas, but through an iterative process, we've narrowed down a proposal package. We hope this is a productive first chance at this kind of proposal, because we have record of all those comments, and we'd like to consider them in the future, perhaps in a similar kind of initiative. So, like I mentioned, over 130 responses were noted. So the self-selected benefit that people indicated in their survey responses tallied up in this way, with the majority favoring transparency and clarity in development processes. Many respondents saw that their comments on the codes and potential updates have effects in more than one or multiple benefit areas, which is a really great framework for trying to make a significant impact with thoughtful sort of incremental steps. Just to touch on some other themes, it was cited to be very important to highlight high quality built environment, reduce costs, especially in the area of affordable housing, less time and steps for the permitting process, and of course, improving climate resiliency. So through that iterative process, we have fallen on 10 sort of parts of this update proposal. They are color-coded up on the screen here because they are actually in different documents, and I'll describe those in the next couple of slides. But as you can see, all 10 here, starting there under improve PDSD processes, allow administrative special exception for certain water well upgrades, remove the PDSD director decision process for wireless communication facilities that are co-located, require zoning examiner legislative procedure for major change in condition. I'm going to jump down to remove barriers for small-scale infill, since we are focusing on the UDC tonight. And that includes remove setback requirements between townhouse units, reducing parking requirements for small multifamily residential development, and allowing accessory structures in front yards for shade and for carports. And then under simplified development standards, the item is standardized building setbacks on major streets and roads. And the presentation tonight also includes correction of minor errors throughout the code. So I said a couple times that the full proposal package affects more than one document and each has its own amendment process. We are focusing on the Unified Development Code, the UDC. That's the main one that many of you are very familiar with. The admin manual here on the screen in orange is supplemental to the UDC. It establishes more application requirements, procedures, and fees, and its amendment process is different from the UDC. It can be initiated by mayor and council, the city manager, or an applicable director, and the final decision is made by the director. And then the technical manual is really focused on just that, technical standards. So that is a different process again. It includes the City Development Review Committee and is decided by the city manager. So tonight's focus on the next slide, please, is just the UDC. And so that explains the shortened list from the full code package provided, just to give you context. So that's why we're here tonight. And just as a visual, those are the items that we're focusing on tonight. So I'll go into some of the outreach and give more background there. Our team held 2 public meetings to gather feedback on the full proposal. That was last month. January 10th was a virtual meeting, and January 12th was in person. We had 90 people attend between the 2 events. And after a presentation, there was discussion and feedback, and our team took down comments of both support and concerns through that discussion, as well as through paper and online comment forms. So feedback from the meetings was generally supportive of the package altogether. There were requests for a more detailed look at a few items, including considering parking impacts on neighborhoods, in the item to reduce parking requirements for a small multifamily. But within that, there was also support for more varied housing types and reduced impervious surfaces that are potentially supported by this kind of reduction. Additional comments included support for sort of people-friendly and vehicle-friendly flexibility in providing sunshade structures in the front yard as an accessory, although there were concerns about their effects on contributing historic properties, and that was paired with a suggestion for the State Historic Preservation Office to do a courtesy review. Also, under the item for standardizing building setbacks on major streets. There is a suggestion for setbacks for taller buildings so that sight lines and bulk reduction might be improved. And then at the end of last month, we held a Planning Commission study session. Many of you know. So the comments I'll go through here that came through in that discussion. And then later on, Dan is going to incorporate them into his details on each of the items, just so the context makes more sense there. But some comments that came through from the Planning Commission was concern about how many private water wells might be affected by the proposal for the Tucson water wells. Also concern about the proposed smaller process for minor changes conditions. There was mixed support for parking reductions for that small multifamily style development. Concerns about minimum lot sizes in regards to reducing setbacks or eliminating setbacks between townhomes, and some concern about the continued ability to reduce setbacks for residential use on streets with 140 average daily traffic counts. And then again, from the public side, and that has been mostly through submitted comments since the study session. So there's been general support for this code package, both support and concern around parking reductions in small multifamily development. That has been a pattern throughout the pros and cons of that particular proposal. Comments about the historic impact of those shade structures in front yards and support for a more standardized approach to setbacks on major streets. Clarifying questions about when we talk about different sizes of infill, what really counts as small, and some cited concern about adding the zoning examiner legislative procedure and the consistency of that. So that's been a lot of the background on how the proposal was put together and our outreach, and I'll hand it over to Dan to go into more of the details.
Great. Thanks, Acacia. I really appreciate you going through the background on that and talk a little bit about the proposed code update package that we have in front of you. So there we go. So just kind of touching back on kind of what Acacia went over previously and kind of how this is organized. While there are amendments to the Unified Development Code, Technical Standards, and Admin Manual, what we're looking at tonight is really related to the Unified Development Code. That is the Planning Commission's purview on amendments to that. And they are in these four categories, talking about PDSD processes, removing barriers to small-scale infill, simplifying development standards, and then those minor code errors that are really non-substantive things, but things that can lead to confusion when applicants or homeowners are reading the code, or when we're reviewing the code as staff. So how these were chosen, the following criteria was really utilized to choose the 10 proposed updates or those 7 UDC updates. So the overall, basically of how we looked at these were overall impact of the development process, how much of an effect will it have on that. Hopefully that it results in a reduction of staff resources to review or administer for a reduction there. We are looking at what would have minimal negative impacts on existing development or properties as well. So biggest bang for your buck, I suppose, or low hanging fruit. And then legal feasibility of the proposal. This is something just kind of related to, we had several suggestions for mirroring the Pima County commercial lot split. And how they deal with those. And that really came down to a legal issue that those are dealt with differently at the state level. We are allowed to do as a municipality. So that's the reason why that was not able to be addressed, particularly with this. There were also larger policy related things that came up for this. So items such as revisions to our flexible lot development, these are things that really are generally done as one-offs. We had several requests to reduce parking minimums and removing all discretionary processes. And then there were a lot of climate related items, which, you know, we will be getting direction from our climate action plan, which is currently being reviewed. And those will likely be here in the future. We do want to mention that just remaining suggestions, because there were so many comments and so many suggestions, will be added to an ongoing list and will be a part of future packages as we go forward with this. So these are the seven in front of you, as Acacia had gone over, in those four categories. And the first one that we're looking at here is related to allowing administrative special exception for certain water well upgrades. So this one is looking at a process that basically, as it is currently, we require a zoning examiner special exception for this, and which is a pretty extensive kind of public process just for upgrades. In a lot of cases, these upgrades are very minimal, if they even have an impact on there. A lot of times it's actually smaller. So what we're looking to do here is something that supports public utility function, helps with more efficient kind of staff review, and still has notice, but maybe not quite as much notice. So our proposal here is, and this is kind of just an example of, of an existing site here. What you have is all the light pink are things that are currently there, and then new features that kind of light pink one is the new feature. So what's happening is actually the shade structure is getting a little smaller, and they're replacing the equipment, but nothing is really changing as far as the visual impact or anything of that sort. We did have a comment from Commissioner Zagier related to this. And ultimately, actually, you know what? And she was concerned about private water wells and if this would lead to a proliferation of private wells. We did reach out to Tucson Water and kind of looked at how those are regulated. They're regulated really pretty strictly by the state and Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. This really is intended for upgrades, not new facilities as well. So this would really only apply to those municipal water well upgrades and would not be being applied to the private wells that you see really outside of the city and outside of the service area for that. Next one that we have here is related to removing the PDSD director's decision process for wireless communication facilities that are co-located. So as it is right now, there's this director's decision process that is required in addition to the standard zoning and building review processes. We get about 40 or 50 of these annually. But in the last, since 2018, we haven't really had any site-specific conditions for them. Essentially, they come in, get reviewed, and then they get approved, and then they go over on the zoning. What this does help to do is that it helps to incentivize co-locating instead of putting up new towers. So the goal here really is to help with that process that isn't really providing much of a benefit, but would incentivize or help to lead to more, hopefully, co-locations instead of new towers going up related to this. I do want to point out that this is not would not apply to new towers or the new 5G facilities. It would just be on existing poles and existing towers for co-locations. Third one in front of you is to require the zoning examiner legislative procedure for major change in condition. So this one was directed by Mayor and Council at December 7th study session. This proposal basically would align our major change of rezoning condition with other similar processes, such as what we do for a change of condition for a planned area development, for our mayor council special exceptions, for zoning examiner special exceptions. It has pretty limited purview, 1 to 3 cases or so annually between 2018 and 2022. So the last 5 years or so, we haven't seen that many of them. It's pretty consistent going back a ways too. But we did have some comments at our last meeting related to this, just to kind of talk about maybe a minor and major process for this. So this is a major change of condition. There is direction in our unified development code for what a major or a minor is. I just wanted to talk real quickly about that. It looks like Commissioner McCann, have your hand up.
Yes. What on the previous slide? What are federal shot clock requirements?
Oh, okay. So there are requirements for federal requirements for cell towers. This is in order to keep municipalities from basically dragging their feet and keeping new facilities from going in. So you have, I believe, it's 90 days from when the application is received to when it's approved, in order to basically make sure that they meet all the conditions of the code and then approve them.
Great, thank you.
Yep. Yes, and then so back to the major changes of rezone. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm trying to get my hand off.
Okay. No worries.
Got it.
Cool. Minor and major change of rezoning conditions. So major change of rezoning conditions are those that meet kind of this following criteria, just to kind of clarify that there is a minor process for smaller changes versus larger ones. There's also an administrative policy for ones that really don't make much change at all as well, but need to be made. Essentially, if density or there's an increase to non-residential floor area by 10% or greater, or more than 50 units, it would trigger that major change of condition. Design conditions that are established to adapt specific or specific site conditions or intended to mitigate development impacts on a site or surrounding land uses. So if there was a requirement for a wall that would be there for screening on the, from the neighbors that are nearby, it would be something like that. If that were to change or need to change, that would have to come back because that would be changing that that mitigation measure that's been put in there. A use condition that involves an illustration on a preliminary site plan or a change in a condition that only a specific set of uses are permitted on the site. So if there's limitations on uses, or if you have generally what happens with the rezoning, you have a preliminary site plan that you get approved. If the orientation of those buildings change, or the uses of or the types of those buildings change on the site, it would have to come back for this. Again, that's one of those things where generally, you have expectations of what is approved as a rezoning. This would change what those expectations would potentially be. And then change to a preliminary site plan when a building area is substantially reconfigured, such that traffic generated would increase by 10% or greater. So if it has a larger traffic generation, that would require you to come back and do the major change of condition. Commissioner or Vice Chair Wellett, I see you had your hand up.
Thanks, Dan, appreciate it. I appreciate you coming back with this clarification as between the difference between major and minor changes. But just wanted a little bit of background on can you talk about a little bit more of the impetus for this change? I understand that this was a directive, passed down by mayor and council, but can you give us commissioners, your understanding of the background as to why this is being requested, especially if it's, something that's very limited in scope? If we're only seeing 1 to 3 cases of this annually, what's the history of this, why this is necessary at this time?
Of course, yes. Thank you, Vice Chair. So ultimately, what the impetus for this direction were a couple different things. One was to make it consistent with other processes, but also it would allow for when there is a major change for the public to get educated on it early enough to be able to provide their input so that gets basically incorporated into the zoning examiner recommendation and potentially the proposal and conditions before it gets to mayor and council for that public hearing. Instead of what ends up happening is there's a proposal, there's a public hearing that's noticed, and then they work it out at the table in front of mayor and council. So it's basically creating a process that allows for that public input to be incorporated prior to it showing up in front of mayor and council.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Of course. All right. Okay. Next one is to remove setback requirements between townhouse units. So this is one of those situations to where, as it is now, it's challenging to build townhouses, basically because our code has internal lot line setbacks for attached units, which make it pretty much impossible to do with the underlying zoning and forces you into either creating a condo and then converting it, or basically using the flexible lot development, which incorporates a whole bunch of other different standards as well. The proposal here would be that in zones that allow for multifamily, R2 or higher, you would allow for single family attached dwellings within those, and then clarifying that those interior setbacks do not apply between units. You would still have all of your other setbacks that would apply, perimeter yard setbacks, but the interior setbacks would not. The goal here is to facilitate a type of development, missing middle housing that provides really more home size and cost options for people. It helps to encourage that small scale infill development that they're trying to do. And it really allows for more efficient use of space on sites for these. This is a housing type that is already allowed as a rental. So it's something that we see as, yes, it can already be a rental, but it just can't be as an ownership unit, essentially. We have received some feedback from Commissioner Martin related to this. Just about the limited applicability due to the minimum lot size. We did make a change in your materials between last one and this one that basically would allow for minimum lot size that's equal to what's allowed for by multifamily development currently. So it did reduce those minimum lot sizes for the townhomes to allow for them to fit on the sites. One other thing that concern that that has come up related to this is just that by allowing for it by right instead of the flexible lot development, you don't necessarily have a couple of those protections that are in there. One is the two-story next to the one-story. The other one is privacy mitigation, which was, you know, hashed out within the flexible lot development a while ago. Related to this, this is no different than a current single-family home and their requirements. So what we have and this that the flexible lot development doesn't have. Flexible lot development allows for reduced setbacks from the perimeter. You would still have to meet the perimeter yard setback, which is a variable setback. So at the taller you get, the further back the building would have to get. So by reducing the internal setbacks, the external setbacks would still have to meet what is currently allowed by that zone, essentially. So next one on the list is related to reducing parking requirements for small multifamily residential. As it is right now, commercial parking standards are triggered on sites with three or more residences. This requires more space dedicated to things like landscaping, but also you know, basically paving. It ends up results with more impervious surface, stormwater runoff, things of that sort, and then less room for actual housing on those sites. What we're looking at here is making a change to several things in order to allow for more efficient uses of those sites. First one is requiring one parking space per unit for sites with 2 to 5 units. So that's what small scale, that's what we're talking about, smaller multifamily for this. We would add in more flexibility for some of those design standards. So those are things like surface requirements. It would still have to be a dust-proof surface, but maybe something that isn't necessarily asphalt. We would allow for alley access in certain cases, as long as the Department of Transportation has reviewed it and it's an alley that can handle it. And then, yes, those alternate surface requirements. Our hope here really is that this helps to lower the number of sites that trigger commercial parking standards. It encourages that small-scale infill and allows for that more efficient use of sites. We have had some concerns about parking impacts on neighborhoods, including the negative effects on walkability and aesthetics. Just related to that, this does, there's always trade-offs. This does help to achieve climate goals of the city. So reduced urban heat island effects, stormwater runoff, supports transit. It helps to reduce cost of development overall. So one of the things that comes up and continues to come up is just that parking on average adds about like $142 per month to rent. So when you can basically remove or reduce the amount of parking spaces for each unit, the rents come down related to that. So it helps to reduce those costs of development for that and potentially build more housing and more housing units. It helps to support infill development, increased density, and more efficient use of infrastructure. And it does, the use of on-street parking utilizes paved area that otherwise would be unused. And when you have a narrower area in your street and cars parked there, it helps to reduce traffic speeds on residential neighborhoods. Next one, number six, is allowing accessory structures in front of yards for shade carports. Current issue related to this is that front yard shade protection is restricted to structures attached to the main building or limited through variance procedures. So our proposal here is to allow for shade accessory structures with certain size and dimensional standards, so 400 feet size. And our hope here is that it does a couple things. It allows for more flexibility in adding climate appropriate shade protection, but it also encourages people that, so the current process right now is you have to go to the Board of Adjustment to do a detached shade structure. In a lot of cases, they'll go through, review it and approve it. The other alternative is to attach that structure to the front of your building. We see a lot of people doing this as well. That is by right. They can go ahead and do that, but they can't do a detached structure. So our hope here is to do one of two things. The person that wants a detached structure, we're encouraging them to come in and put in a kind of well-designed structure if it's detached. In a lot of cases, what ends up happening is they learn that they have to go to the Board of Adjustment. They go home and they just put up something anyways, which generally is kind of substandard materials. A lot of the stuff that you see kind of falling apart sometimes, and there's, kind of the canvas kind of ripped and everything of that sort. So we're hoping to get them to come in and do that. There has been a concern about historic properties and how this may influence that or affect that. There's a couple things related to this that we just want to point out. This really would not exempt historic preservation zones or the neighborhood preservation zones from a portion of the code. They would still have to go through the HPZ and NPZ design review, just like any development. So those are still protected related to that. We also want to just the fact that as it is now, and we've discussed this with our historic preservation officer, is that incentivizing essentially, which is what we do, incentivizing attaching the structure to the front of a building has a larger effect on the contributing status within those National Register historic districts than what we're proposing, which would be the detached structure, which does not affect the actual facade of the building. And would have less of an effect on potentially delisting those structures. It's not to the level of something like an opaque wall in front, which could potentially delist the structure. It is a transparent structure that you can see through, and in most cases would not have any effect on that related to that. Okay, and then number seven is related to standardizing building setbacks on major streets. So the issue here really is that we have variable setbacks along our major streets. What happens, as you can see kind of in this graphic here, as you go up, it pushes you back further with your building. And you see what ends up happening is that you have one, an inconsistent setback of buildings along our major roads, which is not a very good urban design principle. But also what it does is it pushes it back further, and it leads to a situation to where you have a sidewalk, and then you have parking and asphalt, and then you have the building, leading to a couple issues. One, the pedestrian trying to get to the building that's over here has to cross the parking lot and deal with all the traffic and cars that are there. You have the person, also the pedestrian, walking along the asphalt, dealing with the urban heat island effect that's there as well, related to that. And then it also, I'm just the feeling of walking in an area that's super open where there's asphalt and then a road is not particularly comfortable either. Having that building there helps with that comfort of that area. So what we're proposing here is to standardize those setbacks on the major streets to 10 feet for the non-residential development on arterials and collectors. We did make a couple changes to residential. The goal here is not to make, is basically to simplify those, so it's easier to understand. It was not to make major changes related to that. I'll talk a little bit about this in a second. Commissioner Martin's comments that he had put forth, I think we've addressed them to make sure that at least all current rights are maintained moving forward for those residential setbacks. So what we basically have here, and then we have received a little bit of suggestions. This was back from our public meetings for step backs for taller buildings related to this. What we've looked at is that there are very few, and I'll show this in a second, areas along major corridors that allow for buildings taller than 40 feet. So we have pretty low building height standards in the city of Tucson. And generally step backs are used on roads with more narrow rights of way and not necessarily rights of way like Tucson's major roads. So I think Fourth Avenue step backs make sense because it's much more narrow. A lot of our areas downtown, as you start getting into places like Grant Road where there's 150 foot right of way, generally the rule is about half the right of way. So like 75 feet or so is an appropriate building height to be right up against the road. That is something we did look at and we took seriously. I think that once you start to take a look at the map I have here in a second, you can kind of see the limited impact that could potentially have. So just kind of as an example of this one, of the two different types of things. So Acacia did a good job finding two different safe ways that we have here. This one is along St. Mary's, which is a situation, again, where the building is set back. You have the asphalt here, and then you have the sidewalk running here along with the road. And then this is the kind of alternate situation, which would be, a safe way here that's potentially two stories, right up against the road with the sidewalk and then the road here, creating kind of more of that pedestrian environment related to that. This, just as an example, we did that analysis. The 75, the one, the areas that are greater than 75 feet, most of these are industrial areas or they're OCR1, OCR2, and they're downtown. So if you look here, that's the airport. That's all I-2. All of these down, these are all in the approach departure corridor for Davis-Monthan. That's all industrial land. This is industrial land as well as some of the land out to the east. There is 4646 Broadway, which is OCR1. That is over 75 feet. That's that tall building that you see out there, which doesn't meet current setback standards. We have different setback standards now than we did when that was built. And then this one right here is actually Tucson Medical Center. Beyond that, there are very few areas that allow for greater than 75 feet in the city of Tucson. There are some that are between 40 and 75 feet. Not a lot, but you can see some of them. There's a little stretch that's along Speedway here, kind of east of Country Club. And there's a little portion over here that's along Grant Road and First that's over here. But very little areas that this would actually have an effect of having really tall buildings right up against the road. And then I want to just really quickly go back to what I would talk about previously about the, this was that comment about 140 average daily travel roads. So this was a standard when we were trying to simplify and get rid of all of our standards based on either variable setbacks, developing areas and established areas, along with basing it on average daily travel. We had three categories of average daily travel. Each of them had different setback standards. It was very confusing for applicants. It was confusing for our review staff as well. One of those was related to 140 ADT average daily travel that was utilized, that is utilized on smaller roads and is used quite a bit for flexible lot developments and some newer subdivision residential developments. Our intent wasn't to get rid of kind of rights that people currently have, development rights, and they're utilizing quite a bit. Our goal was really to address the commercial arterial and collector streets. So we went through and made some changes, and this is kind of a change that we're proposing to put forth into this. And it's basically just limiting it to 14, changing basically 645C1D3 and adding on a portion on there to limit it to basically streets with 14 or fewer units that have primary vehicular access. And that is the equivalent of 140 ADT, which generally we think of as a house as having 10 average daily trips. So that I wanted to just kind of point that out. That's not in your materials. That would be a change that we would be recommending to the materials in front of you.
Hey Dan, I've been trying to raise my hand, but I guess.
Oh, I thought you were clapping. Okay, sorry about that.
The standard doesn't work because it requires on-street parking, and that requires a 51-foot right-of-way, where the reduced setbacks are used is usually with the 40-foot right-of-way that has no on-street parking. So this does take away the existing rights under the code. So I was out doing some work and I wasn't able to read it fully this afternoon. So if you keep the on-street parking, then this won't work. I apologize that I wasn't able to, look closer at this today. So,
No, thanks, Commissioner Martin. I mean, we can, again, the intent here is to make sure that we're not taking away anything from this and not making any major changes to those residential setbacks. We're happy to remove the, if that's your recommendation, we can remove that on-street parking portion.
Yeah, well, this does because, like I said, we use the narrower street all to increase the density, because otherwise, have parking on both sides of the street, you have to have a 51-foot right-of-way. So that contradicts trying to increase density on smaller projects. 14 lots are fewer, but at least on the street. So. Thank you.
Okay. No, thank you, Commissioner Martin. I appreciate it. Commissioner Wellett, you are Vice Chair Wellett. You have your hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. Just out of curiosity, if these, whether the language is correct here tonight or not, can you speak to us as to what process, I understand we're working through, some changes and trying to you know, land on a target, if you will, as to what's acceptable, what's not. And some of those things come with, you know, just experience, if you will, and seeing what changes work and how the community reacts to those changes. So, you know, can you advise us as the commission as to what, you know, if something were to change today, what other processes are available for applicants going through the, you know, the process here if a setback doesn't work for their project and they need to ask for a reduction and perhaps a modification to those rules of measurement, if you will, as to how they relate to on lot development for homes and setbacks, what have you, adjacent to lower trafficked streets? What processes are available?
Yeah, of course. There are a couple different ways to potentially reduce setbacks. One, via the flexible lot development, but again, I don't think this would quite address that. You could do so through, you know, either a variance or potentially a DDO. That said, the goal here really is not to make a change that would require that. So we just want to make sure we get it right. That's all. And it sounds like if we remove the on-street parking portion, we could also potentially go back and just add in the 140 ADT and just leave it at that, if that is the recommendation of the Planning Commission. Our goal, again, the goal here was not, it was basically just to clean it up to make it a little easier to understand. So that's also something we could potentially do moving forward.
Yeah.
Commissioner Martin. Yeah.
Firstly, I have an issue about how this is being represented as a reduction or a standardization of setbacks along major streets and routes. And, you know, in the last 2.5 weeks, the residential streets got wrapped into it. And I just have a real concern that there's unintended consequences of this language. I don't know if there's 207 issues if this goes away. With, you know, and I don't know that it can be worked out, you know, at the meeting tonight. So those are my comments.
Thank you, Commissioner Martin. I appreciate it. I saw that someone who has a name of guest had their hand up.
Hey, Dan, this is Elisa Hamblin. I think that was me that had my hand up. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I did also want to respond to the earlier comment about what processes are available for setback reduction if this doesn't work. There is a clause in the FLD that does allow for some different site design flexibility based on best design practices. So I still believe that there is some options there to avoid going into a variance or a DDO kind of territory. But I would also just like to provide a clarification on the street setbacks, if you don't mind, real briefly. The reason that we have tried to add this section here on the street setbacks for residential is because the way the code is structured right now has to do with the type of area you're in, established versus developing, and we're trying to break it down into more non-residential versus residential. So there was no way to really address the major streets and routes without addressing both of them. In existing residential neighborhoods, we are not proposing any change, and we're really not trying to do any change in new development of new neighborhoods either. And I think this is the goal, is to try to make it clearer for administration and also for design. And again, because those sections of code are so interrelated together, they kind of had to be addressed at the same time. Thank you for letting me tack in that information.
Vice Chair Wellett.
And maybe you guys had thought about this or what have you, but just out of curiosity, has there been any exploration as, you know, a way in which we can revise the standards too? Because I understand Elisa's point there 100%, and that is a confusion as to how to interpret perimeter yard setbacks based on the area type and figuring out what area you are. So I appreciate the revision to create an easier and more interpretable code, if you will, that's consistent across the board there. But has there been any exploration as to, you know, perhaps create an option where we retain that ADT chart that, you know, Commissioner Martin is referring to that discusses the building heights based on the travel type? And kind of phrase those, be able to use those to gauge setbacks for residential uses specifically. So rather than it, you know, it removes the confusion for perhaps when, you know, the perimeter yard setback, when you're adjacent to multiple different, areas or different classified streets, et cetera, but also allows for that table to be utilized for those on lot setbacks and what have you.
Yeah. So, Vice Chair, well, yeah, I, like I said, I think there's a way to basically, I think we were trying to get away from the ADT, and that's why we did the 14 or fewer units. I think if we removed the on-street parking portion of this, it would address Commissioner Martin's concerns related to this. We will also make sure that we run this by our city attorney's office to make sure that we are not having any unintended consequences prior to, bringing this forward to mayor and council. But I believe that either of those, either bringing back the ADT or striking the on-street parking portion of this would address those concerns.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Commissioner Kinney, I see you had your hand up.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Real quick, if I'm following correctly, and there's a good chance that I'm not, if we were to remove the on-street parking piece of that, it seems to me that it would be pretty much substantially the same as subsection D2 right above it. So I'm not sure that removing that would actually solve anything. Might just have to get rid of that whole subsection 3 entirely, but you'll look at that, I guess, as you said, you'll take a look at that and let us know what you think.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner Kenny. Yeah, I with direction from the commission, we can make those changes to make sure that it doesn't make it basically doesn't change, or we can just, again, with your recommendation, we can actually remove that portion or just go back to the original 140 ADT and just leave it at that, just to make sure that there are no problems moving forward. Okay. All right. Okay. I'm going to move on for now. We still have some additional discussion we can potentially do. These are just the minor ones. These are the non-substantive ones that we are proposing as well. First one is protective services. We have it set up basically, it wasn't permitted in the RH zone. However, it always was. It was just a translation error from the land use code. Second one's kind of related to just, there was a use table, use specific standard 497E1 for home occupation daycare that was omitted. Some of them are items like table 485, where it was referencing a use specific standard that doesn't exist. But these are the minor code corrections that we are recommending. Again, non-substantive, just clarifications related to that. So with that, staff recommends Planning Commission approve a motion to recommend the Planning and Development Services Code Update Package UDC text amendments to Mayor and Council. and happy to answer any additional questions related to this. Thank you.
Thank you, staff, for all your work on that. I would like to now open this up for any questions from the commission related to the information presented by staff. Commissioner Martin, I see you're clapping again. I think that means you have your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I really apologize that I missed the study session because I have a lot of comments. First one is townhouses aren't really difficult to do. You have to use the FLD. And I guess I'll play the age card. The FLD requirements came about because of higher density development in neighborhoods that had problems with the neighbors. And with the attached units, you could do 100 units or 200 units and not have to deal with any of the FLD requirements that for architectural variation and privacy mitigation. I think, Dan, the perimeter setbacks for the FLD are the same as the, they refer back to 6.3.4, I believe. So you can't really reduce perimeter setbacks in the FLD. And the problem, you know, you had two story next to one story. That's where privacy mitigation came about. But I was on multiple stakeholder meetings this century and the last century. Working with neighbors in the city to try to come up with those standards. By adding the, you know, now there's new text about the density for townhouses that actually give you the density bonuses that are in the FLD without having to have any of the incentives that are in the FLD. So I can't support the attached housing the way it's stated right now. I'm real concerned about the MSNR setback changes because of what it's doing to the residential standards. And I've been trying to work with Dan and other staff to try to come up with something that works, but I don't think right now that it works. There's a potential of losing the reduced setback for smaller development. Just the way the code's written now. So the third thing is the reduced parking for 2 to 5 units. It kind of penalizes individual units that have to have 2.25 units or parking spaces per unit. And I think it could be detrimental to the neighbors. You know, in my email, I suggested that they use the multifamily parking standards. And maybe it doesn't need to be that onerous. Maybe that can be revised, but one space per unit, I think could be a real problem. So, you know, I have concerns that if this is being passed as one by one motion, that I won't be able to support it because of those issues. So.
Commission members, I am going to be, when we get to the point where we're making motions, I'm going to be separating each of these items out and we'll be able to vote separately on them. So if there are items that don't have any concerns, we can go ahead and get those moved through and just focus on the ones that we think need more work. Did you have anything else? Commissioner Martin?
Not right now, thanks.
Okay. Perry, I see you've had your hand up for a little while.
Yeah, hi. Sorry about that. I just wanted to chime in regarding the motions, and I can do it again at that point in time. In general, when a item is brought to the Planning Commission, the items relate sort of to each other, and the general, you know, process is to vote on the motion as a package. But since all of these changes don't necessarily relate to each other, there's the potential for a motion that includes all of them to just fail because one or two unrelated items might not receive the 7 required votes. So under the circumstances, staff and I discussed the notion of separating out each of the items, particularly since they're not all connected. So just wanted to put that out there. That's why this would be a slightly different vote than is normally the procedure at other meetings.
Thank you. Vice Chair Willett.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that recommendation because I think there's some that are a little bit more straightforward and others that warrant a little bit more discussion. But one item that I'm looking at here, and I apologize that I'm just catching this now, it's as it relates to the Tucson Water well sites there. And Justin, and I don't know if this is a time to suggest this, if it's possible, but we suggest water pumping and storage facility upgrades or expansions are allowed to utilize the administrative special exception there as opposed to the zoning examiner special exception. So as long as that the existing setbacks aren't altered and these three use specific standards are met. And I was just wondering if there was an opportunity to clarify or add some language to use specific standard 4911.8.9, where it talks about the screening type that's required, and adding some language to suggest, in addition to the masonry wall and the compact evergreen hedge, that an option for an additional opaque barrier that achieves the same intent as those two material types can be provided as well. I understand the intent there is to ensure that there is some opaque barrier, but if Tucson Water has the ability to achieve a similar screening type, and I think it's common on a lot of their other well sites to do a chain link fence with tan privacy slats, et cetera, or if they can come up with a completely different standard to allow that flexibility as technologies change and move forward into the future. So thank you for that.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions from the commission? I don't see any more hands going up. So at this time, I'd like to open the public hearing to members of the public who'd like to speak about this item to the commission. In general, there is a 3 to 5 minute time limit per speaker. This may be extended at the discretion of the chair. Members of the commission may ask questions of the speakers, but we do ask that each speaker be timely, as we want to make sure that those who would like to be heard have an opportunity. We have had two people who have requested to speak ahead of time, and we will have those people speak first. So the first public speaker that I have is Sharia Jimenez.
Hi, I'm first. Whoa, I was actually early with my yes. thank you all for having me today. Hi, everybody. Thank you, Dan, everybody who's here, staff are working on this. I wrote the letter, so you have my comments. Basically, I'm in support, as a small business owner. I think that what's happening with the casitas and what I see just in the market is that there is a growing demand for smaller infill and smaller projects. I work a lot with homeowners, and I'm also starting to work with people who own larger properties and who want to do lot splits and create the 3 to 4 units. And so I have two of those projects in, they're still stuck, they're taking forever. I mean, I think these are, one of them we've been working on for over a year. And so it just speaks to me to the difficulty in trying to get these projects done. And how, I think a lot of the development standards around subdivisions and these types of things really are assuming you're doing new construction. But again, how do you do this when you have you're in an existing neighborhood or you're in an existing urban fabric? I think, I think it just gets a lot more difficult. And I think we just all, for me personally, I feel that, density is good, and it's good for the city's bottom line on top of everything else. you know, the more people we have in the city, the greater the, you know, the tax base and the revenue. And, you know, and again, I think that with all these changes, we're going to see just an continued increase in the smaller scale kind of building economy, which I think is really good and really positive for the city, as well as just increased housing supply and all of those great things. So I'm in general, I thought all the amendments made to small scale development were really good and really positive. And then I just had another comment at the end about just development services, because is anyone, I'm confused myself, is anyone represented here on the commission from that particular department? Is this not the appropriate place to address concerns with development services?
No, staff, correct me if I'm wrong. There's really nothing that the commission can do about that. That's an issue that needs to be brought forward to the development services division in the city.
Okay, so who would be the correct person to talk to about those issues?
Dan, do you know who would be the right person for her to talk to?
Corin, were you gonna
Sorry, I was something having an issue. I did just want to, if I could, clarify a little bit, perhaps, Shreya. So the Planning Commission is a volunteer commission board. It's one of our boards and commissions as a city. Mm-hmm. So it's all members that have been appointed by the mayor and council. Their purview is not really the development services side of planning and development services. Their role is to make recommendations on land use matters and issues related to the Unified Development Code. So they review changes to the zoning code, the UDC, like what is being discussed tonight. They also review land use plans and land use amendments. But there's many staff here at the meeting tonight who are part of PDSD, and your comment was received and definitely taken into account.
All right, thank you. Yeah, because just in general, I feel that staff-wise, you know, with the two departments, I think everything the planning staff has been doing has been really great as far as clarifying and loosening up. But then I just feel like the exact opposite is happening on the development services side. Everything seems to be tightening down much more and getting much more strict. So but that's a separate issue. But I thank you all for that. I think I've gone over probably my 3 minutes. So thank you all, and great work, and thank you, everybody.
Thank you. And we'll move on to the second speaker, which is John Burr.
Let's see. There we go. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Evening, commissioners. I know some of you in the past. I sent in a letter today. I apologize for the late timing. It was discussed at the Armory Park Neighborhood Association meeting yesterday because of the concerns that have been brought up by lots of people in the historic preservation community over the last number of weeks. I've been in touch with Dan about these updates since probably October or November. We've had a lot of conversations. I even have his cell number, which I won't give out. I've worked on code before. I worked with Chuck actually on the infill incentive district, the big redo in 2015. I'm not, because the letter's in the record and you can read it, I'm not going to go through everything. And I'm gratified that when presented tonight that HPZs and NPZs are exempt because of design standards within the code. But the concern still is there for historic structures. There really are no protections for any properties that are just in National Register districts. And I realize it could be problematic because there is not a precedent within the code to add new restrictions. But if you're going to be creating a whole new by right class across a whole class, residential units, of changing a 75-year-old perimeter yard standard in the front, that really has kind of gone through the last six iterations that I've been reviewing recently for a separate project of the code. The biggest change was allowing garages in the mid 70s to project into the original perimeter yards on structures. And that's created a lot of headaches and created the issues with the attached garages that the current HBO has talked about. But this new, there has been no precedent for freestanding structures. And I understand that if the intent is to have transparent shade structures and transparent carports, and that their siding of those things are off to the side and don't potentially block the viewshed of an historic property, that's fine, but it needs to be spelled out in the code, because the definition of carport in the code is a building that is open on two or more sides. So theoretically, a proposal could come in where the back and the side facing the house are opaque or solid walls. There's no restrictions on it. It's not defined. And if the lot size is small enough, could be placed in such a way that historic properties and their visibility from the street are gone. Large-scale perimeter walls above 4 feet often delist properties. These new structures have the same, could have the same potential effect. I realize all these things are trade-offs. I do want to say up front that overall, I think Dan and staff have done a great job on the overall package, and that most of these changes are good. There are going to be some unintended consequences, and I hope that the language gets refined a little bit better before it's forwarded to mayor and council, so that you have a complete draft, because I'd like to see the intent behind all of these changes move forward towards mayor and council, but I'm very concerned about the language. My letter included just thoughts on suggested language that I hope the commissioners will consider when they're looking at accessory structures in the front yard. A previous HPO, Jonathan Mabry, often brought up in meetings that certain residential historic districts that have been on the books since the 70s and 80s actually probably would no longer be eligible for listing. And he specifically mentioned Sam Hughes, because so many people put new garages in the street frontage or in the side where it visibly block things. And if new structures are built in front of historic properties, the question could come up. I did not suggest that SHPO should be consulted or make a recommendation on individual properties. I requested that SHPO be consulted and give guidance, because historic property owners have no idea that if they do these and do ultimately end up delisting their individual property, they will lose their tax credits and they will add to the demolitions or non-contributing status in vulnerable areas that are, there are a number of them that are getting close to the 50% threshold of whether they're even viable anymore. So I think there could be serious unintended consequences unless the intent of open, non-blocking carports is not defined in the code change as reflected in the red line that you are referencing for tonight. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. I don't have any other speakers signed up, but if anybody else would like to speak related to this item, go ahead and either raise your hand or just go ahead and unmute yourself and speak up now. Okay, I don't see any more speakers. Can I have a motion to close the public hearing?
So moved, Chair.
A motion by the Vice Chair. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Second by Commissioner Schwartz. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Signify by saying nay. Okay, the motion carries. The public hearing is closed. Now I'd like to open this up to general discussion by the commission of this proposed plan amendment. Okay, Commissioner Martin, go ahead.
So my comments are based on at least 30 years of using the code. Started the RCP and the FLD and working with neighborhood groups. With the issues of development, townhouses can be developed every day using the FLD, and it's not a difficult process. So I am concerned about detached units. It talks about small development, but there's nothing that keeps it from being large scale development. So reduce parking for 2 to 5 units. After you get to 3 units or 4 units, it becomes a subdivision in the code. So they're required to have a street. People talk about parking, on the existing residential streets, but I just see an issue with that with large units, 5 large units, only having 1 space per. I know it'd be great to reduce pavement and impervious area, but it's just not a reality at this point. What was the last thing? Sorry. The street issue, I potentially could change the text to take out the parking. It's hard to, at this point, to come up with something that we know will work. My concern is this goes to council and then 3 months later has to go back for changes when people find out what the unintended consequences are. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Kinney, you have your hand up.
Yes, thank you. I'll speak just briefly on the single family attached townhome proposal. I agree with Commissioner Martin that the FLD process works. In most cases, however, in my experience, there are situations where townhomes make perfect sense, but the only way that you can do them is with an FLD, which doesn't work in that particular situation. And then the other way to do it would be through condos, which also has its own separate set of complicated regulations. Specifically, I'm thinking of the conversion of existing buildings from a previous use, whether that's office or a hotel or something, into residential units, townhomes, for example. The FLD process is technically available, but a project like that can't meet the FLD requirements. Things like open space and certain access requirements and circulation requirements that FLD requires. So in my mind, This opens up a whole new kind of market of potential uses that previously, for no apparent reason, weren't allowed by the UDC. So that's just my thoughts on that one.
Commissioner Martin?
So what I see is nobody using the FLD anymore or what it's currently being used for, because you don't have to jump through the hoops that the FLD was developed to provide. I've got a copy of the RCP from 1989 and it talks about the applicability and what the purpose and density bonuses, and you can even do density bonuses in R1. So I think what it'll do is just make people quit using the FLD for attached units. We still use it for subdivisions. Every subdivision in Tucson uses the FLD because of the reduced interior setbacks between lots. So, but I just see for attached units, no matter what size project, they'll use the new standards. Because you can get 15 rack in R2 and you can get 36 rack in R3. So, you know, go for it. there's standards in the FLD as far as proximity to transportation, saving historic structures, having more open space, things like that to give you the density bonuses, but you no longer need those to get your density bonus. So it just seems like it's unregulated or regulations aren't thought of. So what are the unintended consequences? Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll go ahead and ask a question. We had a couple of comments from, it looked like mostly the development community, about the zoning examiner process for the major change of conditions. How does staff respond to those concerns about changing that process in particular?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Cassidy. So there's a couple things related to that. One is that I think it may not be a streamlining of the process, but it ends up resulting probably in a better process. And in a lot of cases, when you have controversial issues or contentious cases, it could actually end up leading to a shorter process because those issues get worked out ahead of time instead of being problematic once it makes it to mayor and council and they have to continue the public hearing or they send it back or something of that sort. So the goal here really is to create a better process, not necessarily a more streamlined process.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner McKenzie, I see your hand up.
Yes, thank you. Could someone tell me, please, what FLD stands for? And as we go forward, for a newbie like me, could you please spell out these acronyms that you're kind of throwing around that just make no sense to me? Thank you.
Sorry about that, Commissioner McKenzie. Yes. So flexible, FLD stands for flexible lot development. Its precursor, as Chuck had mentioned, was the RCP, which was the residential cluster project, I believe. Basically, it is it's kind of a tool that has been used all over the country for really, it's born out of suburban development and cluster development to allow for you to potentially protect kind of natural portions of a subdivision while having more and while transferring that density to other portions of that subdivision. Over time, it's been changed, became the flexible lot development. Then there were changes made to it in order to try to make it work as an infill tool or for smaller projects as well. So it's had many iterations over the years.
Thank you.
Any more discussion from the commission? Vice Chair Willett?
Well, just a couple things. Just I'm going to go back with the relevance of your comment there and the question there that you begged Commissioner or Chair Cassidy, excuse me, about the major change process there. And so my understanding is based on the presentation provided from staff that, you know, these are really not a whole lot of cases that come up. And so my thought here is, you know, why are we changing a code in a process where it's, you know, not entirely utilized, you know, and demonstrating of being a problem, if you will, unless it's for those more controversial cases that require more public outreach. So I'm wondering if there's a recommendation that could be made here that rather than completely requiring every project to go through a zoning examiner special exception process, because it does, some aren't going to be as controversial as others. And it just adds an unnecessary time, resource, et cetera, on both the staff and the applicant to go for it. So I'm wondering if there's perhaps we flip it, and rather than requiring it outright, it becomes a situation where the planning director at the time of pre-app can make the call and require an additional process be, you know, held. So the planning direction director can say, you know, based on the area, the nature of the project, et cetera, we recommend that, you know, and not recommend that, we require that this is going to go to a zoning examiner special exception process, and it's not just going to go to mayor and council. Again, I don't know if Dan, you can weigh in or what the impacts of that may be for us, but just something I hate. And in light of this discussion of reducing barriers to development, especially ones, you know, perhaps that were already approved and are slightly changing, how do we create a mechanism that isn't going to create added restrictions, but rather allow for that public process to occur in the intent that we're discussing when those cases come to be? And then along lines of the attached product and the FLD conversation that was occurring between commissioners Kenny and Martin, I tend to agree with Commissioner Kenny on this one, and that, you know, not all projects work for the FLD, and I think this is providing an additional option for us to allow for more housing to come in, especially in this time where it's needed. And so I understand the unintended consequences and what have you, and perhaps it is a difference here in my age, but I think it is something that we should take the risk and see what happens with the ability to relook at this and see, you know, what allow those unintended consequences to happen with, you know, staff obviously being at the forefront of this discussion and recognizing it of being a concern, that we can look into that and revisit this if it comes up in a timely fashion. But aside from that, that's all I have.
Thank you. Any further discussion by the commission? Okay, I'm not seeing any more hands go up. So with the completion of the discussion, I'm gonna open this up for motions to vote on the recommendations. And like I mentioned earlier, I'm gonna break it down. So we'll go item by item and take separate motions. So I didn't hear any conversation on the minor code cleanup, so I'd like to start with an easy one. Is there a motion on the minor code cleanup items?
Chair Cassidy, I'll go ahead and make a motion to recommend to Mayor and Council staff's recommendation for the minor code cleanups there without any further additional changes.
Okay, we have a motion by the Vice Chair. Do we have a second?
Second.
A second by Commissioner Martin. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. Okay, that passes. All right, so now we'll go up to the top of the list and we'll start with the administrative special exception for water well upgrades. Is there a motion for this item?
I'll make a motion to have a positive recommendation for this item to Mayor and Council.
Okay, motion by Commissioner Martin. Is there a second?
Second.
So the second was by Commissioner Kinney, I believe. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed, aye. Say nay. Okay, that motion passes. We'll move to number two, the removal of the PDSD director decision for wireless communication facilities. Is there a motion for this item?
I'll make a motion to send a positive recommendation to Mayor and Council for item, I guess it's number two on the list, for approval of process for wireless communication facilities.
Okay, we have a motion by Commissioner Martin. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Vice Chair Willett. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say nay. That motion carries. Moving down to item number three, the zoning examiner process for major change of condition. Is there a motion?
probably going to butcher this here, but I'm going to try and do my best here. So I'm going to make the motion to present an alternative recommendation to Mayor and Council to keep the process, the special or the requirement for this as is, with the additional language to be added that allows the planning director to have the discretion to send this through the zoning examiner special exception process. I hope that was enough of a motion there.
Is there a second?
I'll second, Monica Lane.
Thank you. Motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay. Okay, that motion carries. We will move down to item number 4, the setbacks for townhomes. Is there a motion?
I will go ahead and make a motion to move this with a positive recommendation as suggested by staff.
Is there a second?
I'll second again, Monica.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Abstain.
We have an abstention by Commissioner McKenzie. Did we have a nay vote?
Nay from Commissioner Martin.
A nay by Commissioner Martin. Do we need to take a roll call vote on this one, staff?
Yeah, I believe we should do a roll call vote. I'm going to go through and do that.
Point of order, this is Peary.
Sorry.
Commissioner McKenzie, is there a reason for your abstention?
Yes, I just don't feel like I know enough nor have the experience to vote one way or the other on this amendment or code change.
In general, commissioners can't just abstain from a vote without Commissioner McKenzie's vote. Will there be the ability to for the vote to pass?
Peary, I believe we have enough commissioners here to have a positive recommendation, but yeah. Okay. Okay, Chair Cassidy?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wellett?
Aye.
Commissioner Martin?
Aye.
Commissioner Zagier, absent. Commissioner Pafford?
Aye.
Commissioner Young?
Aye.
Commissioner Ortiz-Pino?
Aye.
Commissioner Schwartz?
Aye.
Commissioner Warake?
Aye.
Commissioner Lane?
Aye.
Commissioner McKenzie?
Abstain.
And Commissioner Kinney?
Aye.
Okay, motion passes 10-1.
Okay, thank you, staff. We'll move down to item number 5, the parking requirements for small multifamily. Is there a motion?
I'll move to recommend approval of this item for staff's recommendation.
Okay, is there a second?
I'll second again, Monica.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay.
Nay. Commissioner Martin.
Okay, we had one nay vote. Staff, do we need a roll call on this one as well?
Generally, I do a roll call if there's a nay, just in case. So let's do that real quickly. Commissioner Cassidy, or Chair
Aye.
Cassidy, sorry.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wellett.
Aye.
Commissioner Martin.
Nay.
Commissioner Shajir is absent. Commissioner Pafford.
Aye.
Commissioner Young.
Aye.
Commissioner Ortiz Pino.
Aye.
Commissioner Schwartz.
Aye.
Commissioner Warake.
Aye.
Commissioner Lane.
Aye.
Commissioner McCancy.
Abstain.
And then Commissioner Kinney.
Aye.
Okay. The motion passes again, 10 to 1.
Okay, thank you, staff. Item number 6 is the detached accessory structures in front yards. Is there a motion?
This is Commissioner Wellett, and I'll go ahead and make a motion to move this item with recommendations as presented by staff.
Second that, Commissioner Ortiz-Pino.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed say nay. Okay, that motion passes. And lastly, item number 7 is the standardization of building setbacks on major streets and routes. Is there a motion?
I'd like to make a motion that recommend approval, but with clarification of the language to make sure that allows the reduced setback or 15 units or less without requiring on-street parking. And I hope that covers it. It's kind of a complex situation to try to resolve tonight, so that it protects existing owners' rights to for development of smaller projects. So I make a recommendation for a positive recommendation, Mayor and Council, with those changes.
I'll second that recommendation. This is Commissioner Wellett.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed say nay. Okay, and that motion also passes. So we have gone through every item in this one agenda item. Thank you, staff, for all of that work. And I think that we are ready to move on to item number 4, PDSD staff announcements. Would staff please provide any updates to the commission?
Sure, I can provide some updates. I just want to mention again that we have ongoing trainings available for our new permit system, which is TDC Online. We're doing those every other Wednesday morning. We had a training today. So if you are involved in the development process and have any questions about how to use the new permitting system, please do sign up or take advantage of those training opportunities. The information is available on our website. And other than that, we continue to do outreach for Plan Tucson, the general plan. So we will be hosting a series of community workshops in March and early April, and we'll make sure to share that information with the Planning Commission as it is available. But we're looking forward to getting much more community input as we move forward with the general plan.
Thank you for that. Commissioner McKenzie has his hand up.
Yes. I believe I heard at the last meeting that our commission would be appointing or sending a liaison to the Plan Tucson group, since we are a, I forget what the terminology was, an approval body for it or something. But I just wanted to make sure I heard that correctly.
Yes, that is correct. Thank you for mentioning that, Commissioner McCancy. We will be asking a number of city boards and commissions to appoint liaisons to the working groups that we are establishing as part of our general plan update process. So we do anticipate that one of those working groups would be focused on the built environment, land use, housing, transportation, and we would like to invite the Planning Commission to appoint one or more representatives to that group to kind of be a liaison between the working groups, the general plan update, and your commission. So you will get a formal request for that shortly, and perhaps that could be a discussion next month, but if you would like to start that discussion now amongst yourselves, please feel free to do so.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did anybody on the commission want to talk about who that liaison might be from this group?
Otherwise, I would just say that that I would volunteer to do that if I'm able to volunteer for that.
Okay, thank you. And we'll move on to agenda item number 5, future agenda items. Would staff please provide the commission with a preview of the upcoming future agenda items?
Of course. Thank you, Chair Cassidy. A couple things coming up in March, on I believe it's March 15th. We have a Sam Hughes neighborhood plan update coming in front of the commission. So we haven't had a plan amendment or a plan update in a long time, but we did have a presentation on area neighborhood plans, I believe, back in the fall. So we'll have that coming to you. And then we have some smaller water conservation code amendments, or one of them that'll be in front of you potentially on that March 15th date.
Thank you. And do we need to take a motion to adjourn at this point with no further business?
Commissioner Cassidy, I believe we have one more item, which is the call to the audience.
I'm sorry. It's not on my script. So we will do the call to the audience. If there's anybody in the audience who'd like to speak about an item not on the agenda tonight, please go ahead and raise your hand or unmute yourself and just speak up. Okay, seeing no hands and hearing no voices, I believe that is the end of the agenda. Do we need a motion to adjourn?
I will go ahead and make a motion there for us to adjourn this evening.
Second.
All in favor of adjournment, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Okay, thank you all. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.